Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's program. I'm Marcus Peter, broadcasting from Acton University 2024. And this is going to be a mainstay of this program because this event, Acton University, was something that was near and dear to Al's heart. In fact, Al was the one who opened the door for me to be able to attend Acton University on a personal level. I longed to attend it as a graduate student, but for numerous reasons, including financial, it proved to be impossible. But being able to attend it now, I'm getting more and more into the same appreciation that Al had. And this is what that appreciation pertains to. In all areas of life, this is what Acton Institute stands for, in all areas of life and human flourishing and even cultural flourishing, faith and reason possesses an overarching say. Jesus Christ's lordship isn't just to be found in the pages of Scripture, even though that's entirely true. Al was a strong proponent of the fact, and that's something he taught me to do, to speak the truths of Scriptures into these areas of the culture where Jesus Christ's lordship not only needs to be proclaimed, but needs to be made manifest. And that's what events like Acton University allows us to do. That the principles that govern sound living out of the faith also make good Christians, good Catholics, able to be good economists and good politicians and good citizens and good thinkers and therefore good policy makers and good community changers. The numerous conversations that we've been having are a testimony to this. So in this hour, we will be talking with David Barnson about how the faith and work movement requires a theological framework that not only transcends just mere pietistic notions and rejects dualism, but also engages in a very real sense the reality of the economy of the nation. Now, economy is more than just the financial structure of the nation. So when we talk with David about the issues that the United States are facing due to the decisions that are made by policymakers, we can also talk about pathways forward because we can think rightly about work and the economy. And then after that, we talk with Sam Gregg about natural law and how that adherence to natural law brings about true human flourishing and a free and virtuous society. More on that later. For now, the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, June 27th. It's the Feast of St. Cyril of Alexandria. And today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Atlanta is preparing to host the first presidential debate of 2024. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump will be on stage at the CNN studios for the first of two currently planned major debates ahead of this November's election. The 90-minute event will begin at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. The Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith has ruled that alleged Marian apparitions outside of Rome are not supernatural, upholding a local bishop's ban on masses and pilgrimages to the site. It is one of the first known decisions from the Vatican's Doctrine Office on Marian apparitions since the DDF issued new norms for discerning alleged apparitions last month. The alleged apparitions included a Marian image that weeps blood and multiplies food. The Vatican's investigation was conducted by Mariologists, theologists, and psychologists, and other experts who found the message of the supposed apparitions contained numerous theological errors. Scientists are saying not to worry about two giant asteroids that are hurling towards Earth. The European Space Agency says an asteroid over a mile wide will be zipping by Earth this afternoon at a relatively close 4 million miles away. It poses no threat, but they say it's the closest flyby on record of an asteroid that size. On Saturday, another huge asteroid will zip past our planet. And a massive sinkhole has opened up at a park in Illinois. The sinkhole stretches from around 100 feet and is seen on surveillance video bringing down a light pole in the middle of a soccer field in Alton, just north of St. Louis, Missouri. KSDX reports the hole is 30 feet deep. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In perhaps one of the most exciting weeks of the entire year, we are at Acton University 2024, and it allows us such an opportunity to converse with not only new friends and faculty members, but also old friends, friends who are who knew Al Cresta and who are friends of the program and the station. And I am joined by one such person, David Barnson, founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Barnson Group, a national private wealth management firm. And they have offices in Newport Beach, New York City, Bend, Nashville, Minneapolis, and a host of other areas. And they essentially manage over $5 billion in client assets. And he's one of the faculty members here. He is teaching two courses. The first is Debt, Crowding Out, and Economic Growth, which is a topic that David has been teaching on and consulting on for many years now. Al had numerous conversations with David about this, and his second course is Full-Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, which is the title of your newest book. Right. So, David, it's great to have you in the program. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the joy is all ours. I want to start by talking about where are we in the debt-to-GDP ratio?
Well, it is not getting better, that's for sure. And the major factor there is the debt side. GDP has grown okay for the last year or so. When GDP growth slows and debt increases, that's where it gets really bad.
Right.
And that certainly happened out of the COVID moment for a short while. Mm-hmm. GDP growth has been all right, but debt growth is faster. And when debt is growing faster than GDP, that's when you get in a lot of trouble.
Right.
It's been going on for quite some time now, since the financial crisis.
That's right. So last year when you were talking with Al, we were roughly at 110%, which puts us in a major budget deficit situation. Where are we right now in terms of that percentage?
Well, there's a number of different ways you can look at it. The debt, the total debt, $34 trillion to GDP, is probably 120%.
That's right.
But we have about $7 trillion of debt that is called intergovernmental. Mm-hmm. It's money that left pocket goes the right pocket. They've borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund, Medicare. The total public debt is a tiny bit below 100%. It had been over 100%. That's probably the more significant number. It's the way we'd view it with other countries that don't have intergovernmental debt. And the problem is you're just not getting robust enough economic growth to outpace the growth of the debt. And the number for years and years and years had been for us about 50 to 60%. We added trillions of dollars to the national debt, and the debt to GDP didn't go up.
Yep.
I don't like adding trillions of dollars to the debt, but at least the growth of the debt was a little bit slower than or equal to the growth of the economy.
Yes.
That's all gone away over the last 15 years, and that's what's caused, I think, the precipice of a real problem.
Right. So since 07, 08, that great financial meltdown, we've been having issues. We've been seeing that ratio come to a point where we reach 100% and then over. So you've got public debt that's one issue. And then when you take a look at the cumulative debt, including intragovernmental debt, that pushed us well past 100%. It would appear that those in federal leadership don't seem to have a concept of just how dire this is in terms of the setting up of policies necessary to remediate the situation.
Well, I would argue it's worse than that, because I think not only does the federal leadership not feel it's dire, but they don't feel it's dire because the public doesn't think it's dire.
Mm.
And there's two reasons for this. One is that there was a lot of fear-mongering and Chicken Little for years, and when those really catastrophic moments didn't materialize, it numbed a lot of people,
right,
made a lot of people complacent. I think the second area with the politicians you bring up is that they are leaving office. So they may do things now that exacerbate a problem that they won't have to be there to clean up later.
Right.
It speaks to the short-termism that I think is a spiritual malady in the culture. A lot of people in the baby boomer generation might very well be in agreement with the data I would present, but they wouldn't be animated by it because they don't believe they'll be here to be affected by it.
So in contrast with Japan and your coined term Japanification, how is America faring in terms of addressing this asset bubble burst?
In every single aspect of what I call Japanification, America is following suit. there's no directional sense in which we are not following the path of Japan, mm-hmm. but in every single sense, we're doing it slower, and that's a good thing. We're doing it with less magnitude than mm-hmm. Japan did, and that's a good thing. Our demographics are slowing, but they haven't slowed as much as Japan's. Our use of monetary policy was very aggressive and interventionist, but not as aggressive and interventionist as Japan. Mm-hmm. And likewise, our economic growth has slowed, but not as much as theirs. I bemoan our economic growth being cut in half. It went from 3.1% real GDP growth post-World War II to 1.7%. Mm-hmm. But Japan had 0% real GDP growth, and they had it for 30 years.
That's right. They had it for decades.
Yeah. And I think America faces downward pressure on real economic growth, much like Japan. But we're getting to that point in a slower pace because we have some embedded blessings and benefits that Japan didn't have. And demographics were a big part of that. By the time Japan faced their moment in the early 90s of an asset bubble bursting and then heading into a deflationary debt mm-hmm. spiral, Japan was already below one child per household.
That's right.
And America had stayed about two children per household
right.
for a long time, although that number has been going lower the last several years.
Yep. And there's a direct correlation between the child per household statistic with the growth of the nation and our projected capacity of being able to get out of this inflationary status.
Yes, by definition, economic growth is the combination of population growth and productivity growth. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to grow economically when your population is shrinking unless you're getting really substantial outpaced productivity growth.
That's right.
It's very hard to get that.
I was going to say it's impossible to get that.
When you have the burden of excessive government indebtedness.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you've got the burden of excessive government indebtedness, but over and above that, you've also got overt government overreach and regulation when it comes to the exercise of the free market.
Yeah.
And you couple those with the reality of diminishing number of child per household, so therefore the growth of the population. Yeah. What's the projected trajectory here of where the United States economy is going?
Well, in the long term, I am unfortunately concerned that it is more Japanified, that it is looking, and again, you see this evidence in the bond market. Even with inflation having gone up for a year or two, right now, the 10-year bond yield is barely 4%. If you assume inflation of 2 to 2.5, then you're counting on 1 to 1.5 real GDP growth. Mm-hmm. I attended a luncheon event with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell last year in New York City, and he said they were looking at a structural long-term growth rate of 2%.
Wow.
They may not even get to that, but that was them admitting that the decades upon decades of over 3% structural real GDP growth are no longer on the table. So I think we're looking at long-term downward pressure on real economic growth, and I think that's all the best-case scenario. I think it could very easily get worse from there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit more curious in the short to intermediate term. Is there a possibility for a productivity boost that I still think eventually runs into the wall of Japanification?
Yep.
But is there, in the short to intermediate term, a benefit from a lot of the factory construction we've been doing, the potential for more onshoring, some business investment or capital expenditure that produces at least a short-lived CapEx renaissance?
Mm-hmm.
The fear I have there, this sort of parlays into the subject of my latest book, is I don't know that the workers are going to be there.
Right, right.
You build a lot of factories and you get a lot of purchase orders to build widgets in American places, and you don't have any workers show up. And I'm very concerned that that could happen.
Right, because when you consider the aggressive governmental intervention for Japan and how it resulted in the stagnation of their deflationary rate, one of the things that assisted in that happening was the particular kind of work culture that the Japanese market possesses, and that's ingrained into the Japanese psyche. That I won't say it stands in contradiction, but it's vastly different here in Western civilization.
Well, it sure is, and there also was just simply not the preservation on multi-generational flourishing.
Yes.
That you hear that a lot, that people will say of a certain age group in Japan, we think we have a pretty good quality of life. We haven't needed new productivity. We haven't needed new innovation. And that it's where they reference the GDP per capita being different than the aggregate GDP. But of course, the problem with that is that by definition, it's not sustainable.
Yep.
That the it's fine for the people that are content with the incumbent technology, mm-hmm. but when they haven't invented anything new, aren't exporting anything new, they don't have flow of capital coming in, they're not attracting foreign capital, then domestically that becomes a quality of life problem. And,
right.
And so you also risk extinction as a society.
That's
when,
right.
when you not only are not flourishing economically, but not reproducing. So all of these are very real problems in Japan, and I use the Japan model more as the form of an argument around where I fear U.S. could go. Because I think what so many U.S. folks have sort of common ground that we would have religiously and economically, so many are used to thinking, oh, something's going to happen that makes the world end. And then if it doesn't end, and there isn't some massive crisis, mm-hmm. it must mean everything's okay.
Ah.
And I don't agree with that. And T.S. Eliot has a line about how does the world end? It ends with a whimper, not a bang.
Uh-huh.
That's what Japanification was. They had a massive moment of a bubble burst in 1989 mm-hmm. and 90. But what they had since then was not a particular event that served as a sort of economic apocalypse. Mm-hmm. It was a 30-plus year slow drip.
That's right.
On economic growth, and that's what I think America's in the midst of now.
Right. So what exhortation do we have then for our listeners? Because this impacts the common man. Like you mentioned, this isn't just a matter of intragovernmental or even intergovernmental debt and spending. This is an issue that's impacting the everyday individual. We ought to be aware of this.
And I think it's very important to realize that our microeconomic activity, our individual efforts, have to be intensified when the macroeconomic environment is not providing a helping hand.
That's right.
A rising tide lifting all boats. Sometimes mediocre performers can end up doing pretty well when the entire economy is growing at 3-4% as it did in the 80s mm-hmm. and the 90s. If we are not going to get that type of environment, it intensifies the need for greater local productivity, creativity, innovation, zealous output. And that's what I think the burden that we have now is.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us, David. Always a joy to talk with David Bahnsen, founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group. And he's delivering two lectures at Acton University 2024. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
What is God's first gift to the church? The Catholic Catechism proclaims God is love, and love is His first gift containing all others. The Holy Spirit, who has been given to us, pours God's love into us. The first effect of love is the forgiveness of sin. The communion of the Holy Spirit in the church restores the divine likeness that was lost through sin. The Holy Spirit gives us the first fruits of our inheritance, the very life of the Holy Trinity. That fruit is to love, says the Catechism, as God has loved us. The evidence or fruits of the Holy Spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. The more we renounce ourselves, the more we live by the Spirit. The mission of Christ and the Holy Spirit is brought to completion in the Church. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that His Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes Him at His word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, broadcasting from Acton University 2024. I'm joined this segment by Dr. Sam Gregg. Samuel Gregg is the Friedrich Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. He's also an affiliate scholar at the Acton Institute. And he is on the faculty of Acton University, and he's teaching two courses, one of which is a core course entitled Natural Law and Human Flourishing, and the second of which is The Next American Economy, Free Markets or Economic Nationalism. So, Sam, great to have you in the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, I'd like to begin this conversation with the entire topic of natural law. We have seen, particularly with the empiricist worldview that's permeating our culture, a reverse metaphysics, if you will, that any conversation on natural law is deemed oppressive and is deemed as not really universally binding, when factually, by virtue of being natural law, that's not the case.
So I think, as I often say in introductions to my lecture on natural law, whenever I talk about it, I think maybe the most confusing thing for a lot of people are the words natural and law. And that's partly because there's a lot of ambiguity that comes up when people use the phrase human nature. Well, what do you mean by that? And there's also obviously competing definitions of what constitutes things ranging from human anthropology to the relationship between the reason and the will, whether we have free will, etc., etc. And we live in a world today in which part of the problem, I think, that natural law has in terms of becoming more accessible to people is that people's conception of reason is highly empirical. That reason is about the scientific method. Reason is about verification. Reason is about what you can measure, what you can scientifically verify.
Right.
Now, all those things are part of human reason. Empirical reason has enabled us to understand much more about the world, particularly the material world. Empirical reason has led to the discovery of great scientific truths, etc. But empirical reason itself rests upon particular non-empirical, non-scientific claims, such as the principle of non-contradiction,
right?
And that's not an empirical... The principle of non-contradiction is not an empirical argument. It's black can't be white, white can't be black at the same time. I can't be me and you at the same time. So these are sort of self-evident truths,
right,
that are not scientific, they're not empirical, but they're true. And that is something that many people in the contemporary world have a lot of difficulty getting their minds around, because reason is heavily associated with the sciences, which again, as I said, lots of great power of the sciences, the natural sciences and the social sciences. But natural law, understanding natural law, let alone accepting natural law, depends upon a conception of reason that is much broader and deeper than just the scientific method and just the social sciences. But in so much of the West today, we've shrunk reason to those particular conceptions of reason, those particular dimensions of reason, that it's very hard to have a conversation about natural law at all.
That's right. That's right. In fact, that's exactly what I wanted to address, that in light of this creeping and ever-growing paradigm of relativism that's permeating our culture, we have the issue of even acknowledging fundamental principles, these first laws of logic. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the one of the first principles of logic is the principle of non-contradiction. It's virtually impossible to have a conversation, a substantive conversation, with an individual about something as prevalent as natural law, if you can't even agree on the fact that there's an objectivity to that which is true.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right, because we live in a world in which people are very happy to go along with the idea that scientific and empirical reason can reveal objective truths about the natural world, about the material world, mm-hmm. etc. What they have difficulty getting their minds around is that that same capacity for reason can reveal to us moral truths that are true in all places, cultures, and times, in which all people can, at least in theory, know. And there's plenty of examples of this. So there's no society that says that murder qua murder is a good thing.
Right.
There's no society that says that theft qua theft is a good thing. There's no society that says there's such a thing as a good murder, right? So we our reason instantly identifies that there's something problematic with these things. And then we live our lives this way, I should mention. I don't know that many people who live in a world in which they treat everything as subjective, right?
That's right.
I don't know people who tell their children, no, you do whatever you want, who am I to judge,
right,
etc. No one says that to their children, right? So,
yeah, the great irony of the consummate relativist is that they're not always relativistic.
Right, and of course they run into the problem that if you are a relativist and you believe there's really no truth, then you run into this problem that you really shouldn't say anything, because you have nothing to say to people beyond everything's relative, so just do whatever you want. But the second problem is that when you say all moral judgments are relative or subjective, well, you've just made an absolutist statement. So that means that not all moral judgments, because it's at least one you think is true, right?
Right?
So that means that the idea that everything is subjective is thereby disproved. It's like skepticism, philosophical skepticism, the idea that we really can't know the truth about anything beyond very surface level things.
Doubt everything.
Right, and to my response is, well, if you truly believe that, then strictly speaking, you should be quiet all the time, because you wouldn't even bother engaging in the intellectual exercise of trying to understand the world if you're a skeptic, because it's a futile exercise. Why do bother doing it at all?
Right, the pursuit of truth becomes a complete exercise in futility. Now, to expand that then to the question of natural law, there is a universality to the entire enterprise of natural law, mm-hmm. and it comes from, all laws go from a mind to a mind. Mm-hmm. So there's something that's been inscribed in the human intellect that possesses a capacity outside of societal influence to understand that these are the foundational frameworks for the flourishing of the human person within the society. Not everyone might agree on everything absolutely concretely, but there's a universality to these principles nonetheless.
Yes, especially when it comes to what you might call the negative principles.
Right.
Like don't kill, don't steal, don't bear false witness. So these are natural law has always emphasized these moral absolutes, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to the thou shalt not. So this is beautifully explained, I think, in St. John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor, which is all lined out very, very carefully. But even things that people say they disagree about, so The example I always use is that there's no one right answer that tells us which side of the road we should drive on. Natural law won't tell you that. People That's can right. reasonably disagree about that, but what natural law does tell you is you need to make a decision about That's right. which side of the That's road right. to drive on, because the good at human life is at stake. So, mm-hmm. you know, one part of the world can drive on one side, the other part of the world can drive on the other side. What people can't disagree about or can't really rationally say, well, no, you can just do whatever you want in this regard, because that would be to endanger the good of life.
That's right.
So natural law actually allows for a lot of pluralism. So the natural law tells you you need constitutional government, I think. But it doesn't tell you precisely that the American way of doing it is better than the French or the American way. It does tell you you need some sort of constitutional order, but it doesn't provide you with specific answers as to what is the ideal constitutional order. But that's a sort of, and the fact that there is difference is not a, proof of natural law's falsity. It simply shows us that natural law, particularly when it tells us about what we should be doing as opposed to what we should not be doing, allows for a great deal of pluralism. And pluralism in that sense is not the same as relativism.
Exactly. That pluralism is an exercise in prudential judgment based on the prior reasoning to the principles of natural law. Correct. But there's a foundational thrust of natural law. You think about the prima secunda pars of the Summa Theologiae. I think it's in question 94. I know in the realm of philosophy, we don't want to think about natural law thinkers, but Aquinas gets this from Aristotle, that foundational principle of natural law is good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided.
Right.
Inherently, every person recognizes that.
Right. When you think about that, who do we know who has said evil is to be done and good is to be avoided? When you flip it around, you realize the absurdity of trying to deny it, which is why I think people generally, rather than say that evil is to be done and good is to be avoided, they generally flip it to say, well, there's no good, there's no evil. And one of the things that natural law does do in that respect is it points out that the alternative is basically nihilism. And nihilism, you know, you can construct pragmatically different types of ways of people to get work together and not kill each other all the time. But nihilism or things like utilitarianism or consequentialism don't give you a principled framework for thinking through these things. It's much more about balances of pain versus balances of pleasure. It's more about, and in the end, I think that ends up being defined by whoever is the most powerful.
Right.
And so nihilism, strictly speaking, isn't about belief in nothingness. Nihilism, strictly speaking, is about belief that power what determines everything. And this is why people like Plato, started using this phrase or co-opting this phrase from the Sophists, that's what they are reacting against. They're saying, no, there are principles for right conduct that are not determined by who happens to have the more spears or guns in our time.
And the reason why the average person ought to think about natural law and do that work of contemplation is not just so that we don't fall into the trap of nihilism, but it's also so that we wind up in the pursuit of eudaimonia. The entire premise of natural law is to lead man towards happiness in its true philosophical sense.
Yes, that's right. And for those who understand and adhere to and try to live through and out the natural law, you realize that happiness is ultimately about choosing the good consistently. So we talk about goods like life, health, play, work, beauty, contemplation, knowledge. These are all self-evidently true. And we are truly happy when we choose those goods and we don't choose against those goods. And so happiness is not about feeling good. Happiness is not about, wow, I have all this pleasure surging through me, so therefore everything's great, I must be happy. It's about choosing and doing the good, and unhappiness is to be found when you don't do that.
Right. And you think about Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics, happiness is the state of the possession of the perfect good, or the highest good. My guest is Dr. Samuel Gregg, the Friedrich Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. He is one of the faculty members at Acton University 2024, and we've just talked about natural law and human flourishing. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
This communion with Jesus and with one another, that being united to Him and abiding in Him, that is the indispensable condition for bearing fruit. That's why our Lord says back in John 15, verse 5, apart from me, you can do nothing. If you're not united to Christ, you're not going to do anything for Him. So communion with Jesus, our Savior, focusing on Him and getting to know Him and be known by Him, that is what makes it possible for us to bear fruit as Christians. And communion with others is the most magnificent fruit that the branches can give. That's one of the things that He's looking for from us, that we have a communion with one another, that we have a love and a concern. Does it mean we agree with one another? Not necessarily.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
I repeat, I'm sure ad nauseum to the guys who are here, a line from Pope Benedict Emeritus now, who used to say over and over again, to be a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but the result of an event, an encounter, a meeting with the living God in the person of Jesus Christ. This and nothing less is what it means to be a Christian. So we said the new evangelization is new in ardor. That's a kind of old-fashioned word. What in the world is ardor? Ardor is zeal, fervor, passion. Are you passionate about Jesus? Passionate about Jesus. Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know Him?
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, broadcasting from Acton University 2024, and I'm joined by one of the faculty members of this year's university experience. One of his courses, which we'll talk about this segment, is The Next American Economy, Free Markets or Economic Nationalism. This is Dr. Samuel Gregg. He's the Friedrich Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. He's a prolific author, speaker, and scholar. So, Sam, we were talking earlier about natural law, and it actually does, in fact, lend a sound segue into our discussion on commerce and therefore the economy, which is that a proper framework of natural law builds a structure for viewing the human person. and the flourishing of the human person is the end of any good economic system.
Yes, and I certainly believe that. Now, there are some people who would argue that the purpose of an economic system is simply the production and distribution of goods. And that's obviously essential for the workings of the economy. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't be very happy. but the thing I often argue is that good economics provides us with insights into particular truths about the nature of human reality that we would be very foolish to ignore.
Right.
And in fact, many of the early building blocks of what we would call economics today were identified by people going all the way. So Aristotle had something to do with this. Thomas Aquinas, I think, had some major things to say about questions of the nature of property, interest, market exchange, etc.
Yep.
Catholic scholastic thinkers, Jesuits and Dominicans writing in the 16th and 17th century wrote extensively on these subjects. Now, they weren't economists. They were either philosophers, lawyers, or theologians. But they didn't think of themselves as economists.
Yep.
But what they did was identify things like the characteristics of money, the function of interest in an economy, things like the beneficial nature of free exchange of trade, the role that property and contracts play in structuring an economy in a way that both encourages commerce but also makes sure that commerce is done in a just and fair way.
That's right.
And so, you know, Adam Smith is very much the founder of modern economics. But if you read The Wealth of Nations, it's not so much a question of him sort of coming up with new concepts. Most of these things were already in place. His genius was to put it all together. But the pre-modern contribution to this was to identify many of these concepts, and then to have people like Smith and others in later centuries put it together into a framework that we now recognize as economics as a social science.
That's right. And one of the great the fruits, if you will, of reading The Wealth of Nations and Adam Smith is that you come to understand that all of those great thinkers that you mentioned earlier, Aquinas and all of the 16th and 17th century commentators, they were still working with an overview of an economic system that was essentially a zero-sum game.
Correct.
The notion of
growth.
The creation of wealth, division of labor, not just nationally, but also internationally, the sheer expansiveness of mercantile trading, all of those things were avenues, were advents of, say, what, the 1900s? But even then, the principles that they commented on pertaining to engaging in commerce, engaging in the work of oikonomia, the economy, are still sound because it's governed by moral principles that hold us to a transcendental account.
Yes, and the other thing that economics does, which I think is extremely important, is that it reminds us of our limits as human beings, because it reminds us that when people act in the economy, there's a certain degree of self-interest that is at work. And this is one of the things that Smith talks about. He says this is people pursuing their self-interest. And what happens, of course, is that self-interest meets self-interest. People form a contract, there's a bond, etc. But it's all underpinned by the conviction that things like you shouldn't lie, you should tell the truth.
That's right.
That and because if you think about it, if you live in an economy in which these things are ignored or trivialized, so, well, I just lie in the contract, oh, no, I won't adhere to that, no, I'm not going to respect people's property rights or whatever, economic growth slows down very, very, very quickly.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I think that certainly Catholic social teaching has done, is to remind us of these pre-economic norms and institutions that are very important for the growth, I mean, for the maintenance, let alone the growth of an economy over time.
Right, at the first principles of the science of economy, if you will. So, reading Smith, for example, you're going to also discover that while it is self-interest meeting self-interest, which is really the adherence of the law of demand and supply, what you're also going to discover is that in self-interest meeting the self-interest of another, self-interest A is now at the service of the
life,
provided a service. So, yes, there is the serving of the self-interest, but at the same time, you've created a service for the society and thereby contributed to the common good.
Yes, because if you're a producer, you need consumers
That's right.
to purchase your goods and services. And so one of the things that Smith talks about market, when he talks about markets, he talks about self-interest in this way, but he talks about how markets harmonize mm-hmm. people's self-interest so that you do end up effectively serving one another. So when you enter into an exchange, I'm giving you this, you're giving me this. We wouldn't enter into the exchange in the first place unless we truly believed it was going to be in our mutual right. self-benefit. Because many people think of the economy as an inherently extractive exercise mm-hmm. or an exercise in oppression. And one of the things that Smith says is that, well, if you're looking for oppression, if you're looking for corruption, then you should probably look at the way in which overextension of the state into the economy
yes.
facilitates problems like cronyism, corruption, etc., etc. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind, because I think there's always a temptation to think that, well, if we have the state do this, then somehow the state will be able to manage this better.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't. If there's anything that the 20th century tells us, is that communism, socialism don't work
yep.
because they try and supplant the human individual mm-hmm. from the economic equation. Mm-hmm. People like John Paul II talks about this in Centesimos Annos.
Mm-hmm.
He says
that's right.
one of the fundamental errors of communism and socialism is that it denies human individuality, mm-hmm. it denies human freedom.
It's a misunderstanding of the human person.
Correct, correct. It's based on a false anthropology of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fall into the trap of adopting a false anthropology of the person, then everything else, whether it's the nature of government or civil society, if you even have a civil society in those right. conditions, or the economy is based and operates upon false premises.
Right.
So you get economic shortages. You don't have a growth in wealth. You have people engaging effectively in a type of extraction exercise, either from the state or from other people. So these are the things I think that many people, because we think about economics, we think about charts, we think about graphs, we think about math, and all that's there, that's part of it, of course. But that's not the whole story. There
yes.
are these anthropological truths about the person, and there are these anthropological truths that are revealed through natural law that I think are preconditions for the flourishing of a sound market economy.
Right, and this is a great limitation of economic nationalism.
Oh, absolutely, because it is not interested in the consumer. It's not. And
to put it plainly, yes.
And it also involves the state trying to second guess what people in business, entrepreneurs, as well as consumers. It tries to second guess people's individual decisions about these sorts of
mm-hmm.
things. And you run into this, what the great Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek called the knowledge problem. Socialism assumes that the state can know everything about what's going on in the economy at any one point in time. Because that's, you'd need that information if you go to plan everything. But guess what? None of us have that information.
Yep.
No one has that information,
yep.
let alone a Politburo or a centralized government. They just can't know certain things. And one of the things that markets do is it takes advantage of the fact that we all have little pieces of information, and we're effectively trading a lot of that information when we engage in marketplace mm-hmm. exchanges. So the more decentralization there is, the more efficiently and effectively markets will work in a way the top-down management of the economy, which is what I think economic nationalists really want,
mm-hmm.
it can't work.
Yes.
It just can't work. It's not a question of wishing it could. It's not a question of, if only I was in charge, it would work. It won't work,
yep.
period. If the theory is wrong, no amount of practical implementation can change the theory.
That's right. And so there are a couple of steps in between, right?
Mm-hmm.
This decentralization facilitates the market actually being free.
Correct. Correct. Without that decentralization, there is no market.
That's right.
Right? So because the alternative is centralization, and that looks like a planned economy.
Yes.
And in a planned economy, there's a fundamental problem in that it can't take account for the degree to which in the conditions of a market people engage in free exchanges. Planned economies don't like free exchanges.
Yes.
Because you can't plan them. You can't control them. Mm-hmm. And so not only does that, I think, lead to deep economic inefficiencies, it also denies human agency.
Yes.
It undermines entrepreneurship. Worse, it perverts entrepreneurship because it encourages people who we all know with these fantastic entrepreneurial capacities and insights to divert their attention from serving customers in the marketplace and thinking about how can I entrepreneurially secure some degree of privilege right. from the state.
So on a practical level, we're already seeing this in this effort for a top-down centralized economic planning structure. Inevitably, what you're going to wind up happening, because it actually can't be anticipated, is, first of all, synthetic asset bubbles being created that once they burst, they result in disproportionate GDP to debt ratios that result in budget deficits.
Right.
And so the common man suffers as a result. When really it's really the enterprise of free exchange within the market that's going to not only correct but set right the economic problem.
Correct, right, because that's one of the things about markets. They correct themselves
yes.
if you let them. Now, that can be sometimes difficult. That can be unpleasant for a short period of time. But the alternative is trying to have the states sort of try and manage the business cycle over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And they run again into what's called the knowledge problem, because to be able to manage the business cycle for the next 3 months, let alone the next 5-10 years, you'd need omnipotent knowledge.
That's right. That's right.
So that's part of the problem.
And see, the proper way to view the free market in society is the way one would view the human person. There's an organic reality to it. Mm-hmm. It's a self-correcting structure because it's always going to seek that which is good for itself and the good of the flourishing of other markets that assist it.
Yes, and so the thing about markets is that you are constantly forced, disciplined to pay attention to what consumers need and want, or even try and anticipate what they need and want, because the moment you lose sight of what your customers want, your business is done.
That's right. That's right.
And so what I call consumer sovereignty is one of the things that markets provide. It provides the consumer is sovereign, not business, right? And the business has to respond to what people want. And so I often say to people, I'm pro-market. I'm not pro-business.
Yes.
Pro-market and pro-business are very, very different things.
Right. Right. Well, thank you so much, Sam, for making the time to talk to
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
So we've been talking to Dr. Samuel Gregg, who's teaching two courses. He's on the faculty of Acton University 2024, where we're broadcasting. He is the Friedrich Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. I'm Marcus Peter.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
The church isn't saying throw out the baby with the bathwater. Throw out all the media. Don't use the media. What the Pope is saying that make sure that what you are doing is enabling yourself and others to encounter Christ more deeply. And you can't do that unless you reach out. You have to reach out to God first. You have to encounter Him in the Eucharist in that personal relationship. And then you pray, you reflect, and then you go. In my book, Beyond Sunday, Becoming a 24/7 Catholic, I talk about the three M's of faith: meeting, mercy, and mission. You meet and encounter Christ. You enter into a personal relationship with Him. He gives you mercy. And then what do? You just sit there and say, oh, thanks, Jesus. See you later. No, you go out on mission exactly as the woman at the well did.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter. The natural law has been inscribed by the divine mind of God into the intellectual rational nature of every single human person that has ever been in existence and that will ever be in existence. There is a universality to that law. All human beings throughout history can agree that murder is wrong. Now, some might argue on the parameters of what defines actual immoral murder, but we can all concur that murder by itself is truly wrong. We can also agree that that to do good and to pursue the good is to be sought at all costs, and to do evil is to be avoided at all costs, and that's the fundamental driving force of the natural law. And why is this crucial? Reclaiming the language of the natural law in families and in societies is crucial. I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at avemariaradio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at avemariaradio.net.